Welcome to the Heretics Podcast. You can get us at heretics.io or send us email at feedback@heretics.io.
Mark, I have no idea why you should be on this particular podcast. I mean, what landed you in this place?
Well, somehow I met you and I needed a cup of coffee and you were polite enough to actually offer one. But do we actually talk about any sort of like technology stuff here? I have no idea.
We do. But if you want to know exactly what technology stuff we talk about, you have to listen to the rest of the podcast. And beautiful podcasts start like beautiful relationships with just a chance meeting.
It's time to talk about change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the Heretics Podcast. Today, Mark and I are joined by Dr. Joseph Langemann. He is the head of engineering and transformation for Standard Bank, headquartered in Johannesburg. So we are continuing our theme of being on as many continents as possible. Joseph has got a lot of experience in driving the organizational transformation of an engineering function. I think we will have some really interesting challenges for him today as he hopefully begins to myth bust about some of these things that actually, some of the simple techniques that you can use to drive small change, which then ultimately turns into big change. And of course, that's what we're all about in this podcast. So, Joseph, it's super good to have you here. Would you like to introduce yourself? Tell people a little bit about who you are and Standard Bank, perhaps?
Yeah. Thanks, Justin. And thanks for the kind introduction. I must say, to have a doctorate in IT these days is more like to be a male nurse. So that doesn't mean much these days anymore. Everybody's these days very highly qualified in IT. Now, my role at Standard Bank is I've been at the bank now for 15 years, and I've done many roles, but the past decade, probably I focus a lot on development, software development, and organizational transformation, like the big agile transformations. And the last couple of years also, how do you transform your engineering? Now, people probably wouldn't know about Standard Bank, but Standard Bank is the largest bank by assets on the African continent. So we are based in Johannesburg and we have operations about in 18 African countries. And my worldwide stance, probably not a very large IT department, but in South Africa and in Africa, we're one of the largest. So we have about 6,000 people. So when we talk organizational change, it is really how to affect change over large groups of people. And that is the stuff that kept me awake the last couple of years. And Justin, I must say, I've learned something from you in that time. I think it was on one of your blogs, and this is something you personally explained to me. It's called the holy shit moment change methodology. Because when you work in a big corporate, you always get all of these clever transformation people, and they have all of these different methodologies and very clever stuff. But you introduced me to the holy shit moment one. And let me explain to the listeners what this is. So many years ago, one of the things we wanted to do was to change the organization to be far more DevOps. And as any big organization, you know, you write your code, then it goes to a CAB, it sleeps there for a couple of weeks, and then when you get the deployment slot, you actually can deploy your code. So those years, this was probably 5 or 6 years ago, it took probably around between 4 and 6 months to get your code into production. And then you explained this holy shit moment thing to me, which I thought, what nonsense is this? And actually, when we tried it, it made all the difference in the world, because you can tell people, build a deployment pipeline, do automated testing, do all of those things. And you know what? They don't really give a hoot. They don't really listen. But one day we had a big town hall, and one of my colleagues, Davi Olifield, was actually giving a talk. And behind him was a big counter. And this counter just started running. Started from 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. Now, there was about 1,000 people in this town hall. And this thing was running, and nobody knew what it was. at 2 minutes, 20 seconds or close to around there, Davi stopped and said, you guys know what? We've just deployed code straight onto internet banking, which was in those years the crown jewels of the bank. Everybody in that audience said, holy shit, I want that. So within like a 2 minutes, 20 seconds, 1,000 people wanted to know how do we build a deployment pipeline. So just that little thing where people say, see, wow, this is great. I want that. You've created such a big demand that people immediately wanted to do that. So Justin, thank you. I've learned that technique from you and you won't find that in any textbook. So thank you for that.
Well, I think that's going to be Justin's first textbook.
yeah.
The big S moment. My jaw has dropped actually listening to, because this is a fascinating story, Joseph. And I think it proves the salience of presenting a big idea and how to do that in order to enable change. I mean, I'm just aghast that that actually came from Justin.
Yes, well, I can see that that would be surprising. that is understandable. But, you know, Joseph, the interesting thing about your example is this fundamental rule that sits behind the change ideas that we've discussed in the past is events drive change. You know, something has to happen to be an example of the change. Because so often, you know, we start change by talking about what we want to be, and we make posters and mouse mats and all of those kinds of things. And we're asking an organization to change to something that we ourselves can't properly and in detail articulate, but we expect them to be 100% all in. And we wonder why they're not. And so the best way of driving change is to create an event that makes someone go, wow, so that's what I can do. Or, oh, that's what you're talking about, right? And the same thing goes for customers. You know, when we're delivering, new features for our customers, the question we have to be asking every single release, this release, what is it going to do for a subset of our customer base where that customer goes, wow, I can do that? And let's be honest, you know, a large amount of the releases that software companies of any sort push are in the background. You know, if you just read the release notes on iOS drops, for instance, mostly it's pretty unremarkable stuff. There's no real, oh, wow, can I, wow, I can do that now? And I think that this discipline of getting to essentially test whether someone is fully engaged with your product and go, we think you're going to think this is amazing. And if you get answered with just crickets, you know, not really interested, that's an important piece of feedback, right?
Yeah, I think, and you know, Justin, you're so spot on. When we as a bank started with a lot of this transformation effort, almost everything is always internally focused. Now you need to save cost, or you need to ship features that make things better for yourself. But rarely we actually looked at what changes for the customer. And it took us many, many, many years to actually make that jump A lot of it is the way an organization is structured, because sometimes you have a separate IT department and they mostly internally focus, do whatever they want to do. You have a business who's focused on making money. They're not interested in the engineering, and never the two shall meet. So what we did in the beginning, because we felt we had more control in IT around the IT landscape or the product landscape. So we pushed features, but it was mostly stuff we thought was important. And so when we started to do a bit more agile, I won't say we great at any of this, but when we started to more to do doing that changed a lot. And then in the last 3 years, this whole testing with the market, where, and this is credit to our home loan teams, they actually that for the first time I see where the business team and the IT team formed one team, and then they brought also the operations into it. So we started to talk about you build it, you run it, which is almost basically bringing ops and dev together. But also we brought the business in that they are one team. And the term we coined for it, which is in a way a wrong term, but we just couldn't think of something else at that point, and it just latched on, is solution engineering teams, which is this bringing all of that together. And what they then do is the business and IT and ops sit together, work together, eat together around the same table, release a feature, and they actually get immediate feedback from the customer. And when we built our first customer journeys around home loans, we used those techniques, and it made the world of a difference for us. And you know what's interesting? The people are happier as well. Because now it's not that ops feels like they're a second-class citizen, or the dev guys think, you know, that we the gods of IT, or business who doesn't want to talk to IT. It's actually one team. And to get that feedback from business is really great. What I don't know, though, and that is the stuff that's keeping me awake these days, is when we do all of these feature releases, a lot of things are not features anymore. They large transformational activities. For example, your bank moves to the cloud, or you're doing these wall-to-wall transformations. You don't have the opportunity to test directly with a customer anymore, because you're actually taking a big bet. And those things, and maybe you have an answer to that, but those things I still don't know how to measure directly with a customer, because it takes time. And when you get to the measuring stage, you're already too much invested. But I would like to hear your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is super interesting, right? Because there's two types of innovations. There's the iterative, and then there's the type that are great leaps.
Yes.
And I almost think of it, like you use the term solution engineering. Mm. I think of those big bets as solution imagineering. Because you're trying to imagine a very different type of environment, operating model, business model, and the engineering underneath to support all of that. And it really does seem like very different types of innovation in enterprises. I mean, Justin, I think that's something that we've talked about like a while back ago, is just the kind of the different models of innovation, trying to operate engineering in that type of fashion.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, if you think back to kind of the early 2000s or you know, like 2001, there was so much being written about innovation and innovation models. And, you know, everyone was talking about Nokia and how Nokia managed to go from, like, essentially, you know, planting trees to making mobile phones. And, you know, what does their innovation process look like? And I think, honestly, one of the things that we've found is that the operationalization of innovation into some separate process just doesn't work, or it doesn't work consistently, at least. And so it's very similar to the engineering challenge, where we have to create the environment that enables teams to experiment in the small, right? Because when we talk about innovation, too often we are hoping that there's this big transformative idea out there, and we forget that, you know, in order to make the light bulb, Thomas Edison went through like 700, I forget the number, but like 700 different little experiments until he finally found one that worked. And so change, like innovation, happens through small events that show progress or not. And so, you know, in my opinion, in terms of your question, Joseph, is I think what we can do is we can break down these big things that we want to do into smaller tests that are directionally meaningful. So an example that I've seen in the past has been If you look at something like personal finance management, and you know there are many applications on personal finance management. A particular bank was doing some work in that space, and instead of putting a lot of money into building out this very elaborate financial portfolio management thing where people could track their expenses and categorize them and all of those kinds of things, what they did is they led with an hypothesis, which was people want to be able to manage their finance better and they want to do it on their internet banking site. And so their first little test was quite simply just a list of the user's transactions with some automatic tagging and the ability for the customer to be able to change the tags themselves. Their hypothesis was, if people are interested in this functionality, we will see some percentage, I forget what the percentage was, but some percentage of our customers will log in and use it and will return. And so that's what they tracked. And they said, well, if we don't get, let's say, 20% of our customers going in and actively interacting with just the simplest possible feature we could ship, it's probably not worthwhile building the rest. And so that's a good example of breaking it down into that, you know, oh, I can do that now kind of event. It's a really small one. So they were just testing, are there customers out there who will go, wow, that's cool, I want to use that, to a little sliver of the functionality. And if the answer was no, then it just wasn't worthwhile building the rest. And if the answer was yes, then the next experiment builds on top of it to say, okay, so would this little piece be interesting? Would you like to have it graphed or automated? But these are small events, small testable things. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, so it sounds like what they're doing is like building the MVP in, you know, the already kind of existing framework as a launch pad for maybe the bigger bet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the you know, so much, and we speak about this on the podcast so often. I think one of the single biggest lessons that engineering really has to get into our teams, business partners, etc., is small bets. Make many, many small bets. Deliver them quickly. Right. So doing big things that take 18 months or a year to deliver any value is almost always a failure. And so small things, small bets that you can go out and test and then decide if you want to keep on going is the most powerful way to deliver any service, not just software. But I mean, coming back to your example, Joseph, you said that the business was part of this and you formed one team. What is critical in the process that I've just described is having business stakeholders there actively looking at the results of the tests and the measurement and prioritizing. How did that work for you? How did you manage that process?
You see, I think what we've tried in the past often is we try to implement Scrum, call it cleanly. And we always got product managers from the business. And these product managers were most of the times just glorified business analysts. So they didn't have any, call it, P&L responsibility. You know, a decision doesn't really hurt them. So we tried for many years to get that concept landed. And then we said, oh, it is a problem with the BAs, or then it's a problem with product managers. And in the end, we decided to give up on that. So we still run it as a Scrum flavor in, you know, short iterations, stand-ups daily. But the business head, the person who runs home loans, is actually part of that team. You know, he calls the shots in that meeting and he's there. So it's not this thing where business just pans off the responsibility to a business analyst or something like that. It is actually the business head that is part of it. And I think what we will see in the future, our bank specifically, and I'm very sure it looks different in the rest of the world, I don't think product management is a very well-developed discipline. If I look and talk to other banks and other industries, it's not as strong as it should be. You know, there's a lot of focus on, call it the developer, and there's a lot of focus on the methodologies, but peer product management, I think, is lacking. And how to land that with the business and create those competencies, I think that is something worthwhile to invest in.
Yeah, I agree. It's here's what I've seen from the product management standpoint is there's a lot of emphasis on being a product manager and all of the language and processes of managing a project, but nothing that speaks to ownership across functions, which oddly enough, you'd think that would be actually the whole purpose of having a project or a product manager. But in fact, the emphasis doesn't really seem to be on that so much. And the focusing of the communication coordination across teams to deliver a result, the result in most cases seems to be, here's the project plan.
Yeah, and I think it's a cultural clash as well, because Mark, you're so right. When you said, for example, that you have to own the whole stack, you have to own things from operations because straight to development. Because if you think about it, there's business features that need to be released. There's upgrade features that need to be released. There's some UX in there. There's database upgrades. There's infrastructure upgrades. There's network upgrade for that matter. And you need to put all this in a mix and own it. But what we've seen is business has a typical culture that goes with them. Then the development guys have their own set of cultures. And then the operations guys, or call it the people that work in the infrastructure context, they have a very different culture to all of it. So as a product manager, you need to be so strong and have your finger on the pulse to actually pull all of these disciplines together and actually look at it holistically, because in a way, each of those disciplines are driven by something different. We would love to say it's all about the customer, and we probably all profess it, but when it comes where the tire hits the tar, it becomes a different story, because then the operations guy says, let's stop change a bit to make the system more stable. Or the business guy says, let's push change more because we need to make revenue. So you need to bring these things together. And then you have the DevOps guys that say, just make more frequent changes and you'll get good at it. But then you need to marry all of these things. And it's so interesting to, in a way, marry these cultural types. And I think Justin and I also discussed it in the past. When you do transformation, I think 60 to 70% of your time needs to be focused on culture. It is actually culture that drives the whole thing. If you sort that thing out, most of the other things fall in place.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I was reading this really fascinating blog post this morning, and I have some quibbles with it, but it was interesting to hear the perspective of the author say, I've seen and I've started working with so many of these engineering operations and DevOps teams that are releasing code so fast in the production that now the business is the roadblock, is the friction. And so marketing gets, it seems to be a bit off. Customer support can't deliver the best customer experience because the products have now changed in almost a seemingly minuscule amount of time compared to in the past. And so I think a lot of it does come down to that coordination, and that coordination ultimately, it's not about the tools, it's about, do you have a culture of collaboration?
Spot on. And it is so hard to drive a culture of collaboration if you call it your performance management systems emphasize different things for different teams. Because if I'm in a grouping that reports into infrastructure where stability is prized over everything else, my behavior is going to be driven by that. If I'm a developer who wants to get new stuff out, or where it is far more about, you know, business features, it's different to the infrastructure people. And business, where it's P&L based. So here's a good question. If you in a, call it in an IT construct, and your big concern is to keep your system stable, to keep your refactoring at a minimum, to do all of those things, and it's starting to hurt revenue, to make that trade-off between the different teams are really hard. So, Mark, again, I think you're spot on. To pull these things together is very, very, very hard. Mm. That's why I think it's hard. It's far more hard than it is a methodology or anything.
Yeah, I agree. I think transformation certainly is an art. Just picking up on one of your points, I've always found the idea of a defect budget in the systems reliability engineering practice very helpful. So if you can essentially set a particular amount of defects in production, and they can be of a variety of different types, but essentially if you can set an amount of defects in production, and if you go over that budget, that allowable amount of instability, if you go over that, that kicks in, essentially it's making explicit the trade-off to then say, we're going to stop pushing features until we fix these issues that we've been having. And so that idea of having the defect budget, I think, is a very powerful way of almost monetizing, what the value is of pushing change. Because the more change you push on an unstable system essentially has two side effects. It has the increased instability of the system, most likely, but what it also has is it increases the complexity of the unstable system because it's adding new things to it. And so this idea of ensuring that you have stability within certain bounds is an important part of driving change. And the same thing goes to organizations. I think driving change in organizations where the organization is very unstable is super, super difficult. So, you know, if you've got two companies that have come together and you then want to start driving a program for how we're going to do this together, you notice how few of those programs actually succeed. It's because what you're doing is you're pushing change, new behavior, onto an organization that still doesn't know how it works together.
Yes.
And that's why so many of these integration and merger programs are just so, so difficult to do.
Yes. And Justin, to maybe add to that, I don't think you can really prescribe a culture. You need to feel what it could be. And it goes back to your event-based thing. So when I started to run dev for the bank, I thought I knew everything. I had a PhD in artificial intelligence. I've been running some dev teams for a while now, and this is more organizational dev, you know, where it is large teams, all of that. And, you know, we did everything right. We had the right project management methodologies. We had the right enterprise architecture methodologies. We had everything sorted, but we couldn't deliver squat, to be honest. We were the slowest in the country. And I was, in a way, losing sleep over this, because what can you do when you're doing everything right and you're still a failure? And I think what happened to me, I had an event in my life, which was we visited Facebook, and we were three people from Standard Bank, and somebody there who worked for us went there, and they introduced us to Chuck Rossi. Now, Chuck, I don't know what he does today, but in those years, he was head of release, and he was a very powerful guy. And we walked in there, and we were the only meeting in his diary. Now, when you work in a large corporate, your day is totally consumed with meetings, ARP meetings to be exact, in a way. We sat there, and Chuck, we were the only meeting in Chuck's diary. Then Chuck said after an hour, because we had an hour with him, he said, you know what, let me go make you a burrito. And he walked down to the canteen, made us a burrito, and we walked past developers and we asked him, so, you know, what standards do you use? Oh, we don't really care. And we asked him, what enterprise architecture stuff, what's your secret? Oh, we don't do that. And basically what he told us is people are reasonably free here. Now, that's at a certain level. I think at a corporate level it's different. But I walked there and, Justin, I felt free. When we flew back, now from San Francisco to South Africa, it's about 24 hours door to door if you take everything into account. I sat there on that flight and I actually decided, you know what, I can just do everything different. Because if I do everything right and it's not working, why don't I just try and be free? And you said in the beginning of this podcast, you need to be, in a way, espouse the change you want to see. So you, in your own mind, need to be free. In your own mind, you need to in a way, have a feeling of what good looks like. You need to know what caviar tastes like. And when you have that, it is easier to do change. So when you said now, bringing teams together from different banks, all that, you must almost use that event-based thing so that they could feel, if we do this through an event, this is how it could be. And when they take that, they want it. Your only trick then is to be consistent with it. Because if you give them caviar when they've been used to something else, they want more of it. And then you need to be better to be able to deliver it over time. Otherwise, you're just back to square one.
So I'm actually curious, Joseph, then how did you take, so that those 24 hours thinking about what you saw and the release burrito, that's what I'm going to call this, the release burrito. How do you kind of take that and start making those changes, the engineering transformation in your own organization to get people to say, hey, let's try this. We've done that. Let's do this. Let's be free, to use your words.
Yeah, so that is an uphill battle because you come back in a way and you think you threw off your chains, but the rest of the organization is still in a different mode. So what we did, and it was per accident, there was one team, I think it was internet banking, that were really up for new changes. And the first thing we did, we introduced Agile, which, take for a bank, we had at that stage 250 PMI certified project managers. To get them now to do something different is really hard. So we gave up on that. So we just said, internet banking, there was somebody who wanted to be a scrum master. We started and do some work with them and we implemented that. At that time, we also got a new CIO. And when she saw the cost benefits and the throughput that this team did, she said, I want more of that. Because, you know, when you come in, you're trying to sweep clean. You need to do something different, so you're looking for new ideas. So she saw that and said, well, let's do more of it. Then through that thing, we did a huge... So people always say change should start from the top or it should start from the bottom. I actually think, I'm not sure about that. What I think could work is percolation. You have some teams who start doing it, it spreads, and then it goes to the top, and from the top it becomes down. It comes down again. So that did that. But what we realized maybe a year or 2 years in that Agile is not enough. Agile gives you maybe a lift of, let's pick a number. I don't know what the number is, but let's say 20%. But to get more lift, you need to do the hard engineering changes, which is, call it the DevOps stuff, breaking the organizational silos, all of that. And what happened is we started almost a skunk works team. We call them Chop Chop. And ChopChop was just about doing things quickly. And there were three people in that team. And all they did was, when people, after that event based thing where people see how quickly you could deploy, people said, come help us to do it. And those three guys then went to teams and coached them how to build these pipelines and how to do those things. So it was always based on a pull model where people said, I want more. We never did it top down in a way. it became top down after a time, but it always started as pull and then it became push afterwards. Now, is that good or bad? I think I would have liked to stay with pull all the time, but you know, when senior executives see the benefits of these things, they just say, I want more of it, and they actually mandate it.
I think it does need support from the top, just because change is sometimes expensive. In many cases, from an engineering perspective, it's very difficult to not build slightly ahead of demand. So, you know, as you are talking about, let's say, building this new pipeline, and you invite people to come and build it with you, well, how much do you build? Right? Just which features do you build first? Yeah. Well, you're probably going to be going out and you're going to be talking to them and other potential customers, and you're going to be prioritizing, well, this is what we think we should build next. And invariably, what you are doing is you are building ahead of demand. And if you are building a duplicate, for instance, to the existing pipelines that they're on, that's a duplicate cost and someone has to pay it. And so it's at that level where resourcing becomes important. I think it's possible to elegantly manage it so that you're not too far ahead of demand, and that you're not doing massive build things, you know, big design up front and all of that sort of thing. But there is a certain amount of top-down resource prioritization that I think has to happen in any organization.
So in a way, I think it's percolation, and at that one stage, it just comes from the top down. And I like your words. It's more, it becomes a pull, and then it becomes support from top management.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Joseph, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation, as always. I always appreciate your pragmatism and your passion for what you do. Thanks so much for spending time with us. I think that, you know, in terms of some of the takeaways from this, what has really struck me is the importance of culture and the basic principle that in order to create a culture, we create a culture by showing people how we do things around here. And if you want to change that culture, you change how we do things around here. Meaning, pick one thing that you can change, that someone is going to go, wow, I didn't realize we could do that. Create that event as the fulcrum of change. I certainly also have good experience seeing the effectiveness of that approach. Mark, any final words please? Wisdom. Give us wisdom, Mark. Wise words for the end of the podcast.
I think a Facebook burrito could be pretty interesting. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other. I just really just kind of wonder what a burrito at Facebook would really be like. Oh, wait. Sorry. We're talking about IT. But in that regard, I always get back to the core issue with any type of large scale engineering transformation is, if all the parts of the train are not aligned, meaning you're not actually communicating and collaborating effectively, the whole thing derails. So even though you may have certain aspects of your organization coordinated, it still requires having the right people lead those scrum teams to be the owners of the product, and also to kind of attach all of that to outcomes that are shared.
Yes.
Because if not everyone is kind of on that same board of saying this is kind of what we're driving towards, and we all agree that even though, yes, my corner, I may care about availability. In this corner, I may care about number of batch sizes and releases per whatever time frame. If not all that's coordinated, it just ends up being a big mess. And I think that's kind of what I took away from this conversation.
Yeah. Oh, great summary. Thanks, Mark. Joseph, thank you so much. We'll be in touch soon.
Thanks for listening to the Heretics Podcast. And Justin, what should people do afterwards?
Please leave a review. Please inundate everyone with your love for, well, if not Mark and I, because let's be honest, that would be unreasonable, at least our guests, which I'm sure you can agree have been fantastic. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.